Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Nice to see you again, Luli. And how are things with you?
All very good. Thank you, Felicity. So hello, how are you? But I want to start off, if it's okay, with a previous rant on car hire with my latest car hire madness experience.
I think I need to hear this. But first of all, this tells me you've been travelling again. Are you ever at home?
Yes, Felicity, I am at home. As you can see on our screens right now, I'm actually in my home office in London. But are you, from your question, implying that I gallivant around the world when you know that the majority of these trips are very, very, very hardworking trips?
That's exactly what I'm implying.
Thank you. Well, let me tell you about the latest one. So last week I flew to Barcelona, or 10 days ago, anyway, just ahead of the Formula One Grand Prix that was being held there in Barcelona.
I rest my case. So you went off to see the Grand Prix. That doesn't sound like work to me.
No. I was not actually there for the Grand Prix. And actually, to be fair, I'm not really a big motor racing fan. Rugby union 100% is where I go for my sport of choice. But anyway, so this rant is about car hire related, but not about car racing anyway, far from it.
Okay, I can already tell this is going to be a story about chaos.
Oh, okay, so how did you guess? So yes, let me rant. So the car rental company this time actually called me a couple of days ahead of the trip and said that Barcelona Airport was going to be super busy when I arrived. So I could do a pre-check-in with them on the phone, and then I'd be able to skip the long queue, tedious queue, my words, not theirs, so as to avoid what feels like they are hiring cars for the first time because the queue takes so long. Anyway, so they said instead I could go to a VIP desk at the airport, which would be much shorter and quicker, and then proceed quickly to the car collection point.
And this is all going to go horribly wrong, I can tell.
Yeah, so you're right. So I arrived and I was feeling suitably smug and VIP-like, and I got to the desk and guess what? There wasn't a VIP lane there. There was just the regular one. Anyway, so I stood in line and waited. Finally got to the front of the queue, gave them my details, and they said, oh no, you're pre-registered. You don't have to come to this desk. You can just go straight to the car park and pick up your car. So I'd stood in the queue for no reason.
So what happened next?
Okay, so final rant, and then I promise I'll move on. So you collect your car from a multi-story car park in Barcelona Airport, and honestly, it feels like you're in a Matrix movie. Yeah. So you're on the second level, which is where you get the car from, and within about 30 metres of driving your car. So let's remember, you've typically just come off a flight, you're at an airport, you're driving a car you've never driven before, and you have to go down this ridiculous narrow ramp that is so sharp in the angle that I think it was probably actually designed for the Formula One drivers that were there. Anyway, it's horrific. And then at the bottom of the ramp, you go around another Grand Prix style corner, and then you go back up the ramp to the floor you were originally on.
Yeah, I think actually there are very specific styles of architecture in different places. Like for me, the French make things beautiful, but they don't manage flow very well, whereas the Germans manage flow extremely well but don't make it beautiful. It sounds like the Spanish are maybe more on the French side. But are you sure you weren't just going around in circles?
No, I wasn't. So I have been to Barcelona Airport before and hired cars, and there literally is just only this weird one bizarre way of getting out of the car park. But anyway, rant over on car hire.
I will point out they are the people responsible for the Gaudi Cathedral, so it doesn't surprise me.
Anyway, how are things with you?
Good. I've been at home for an extended period just getting work done. So I've got this big teetering to-do pile. One of the things I need to do, and this has been putting off for ages, I've got to go and get another headshot.
Oh, okay. So have you thought about doing the kind of the AI route for headshots?
No, because I'm worried enough about being on camera. I don't want to end up with six fingers or whatever they'll give it to me. Have you tried this?
Yeah, I have actually.
Oh.
Yeah, I did. So I got some headshots done, and some did come with extra fingers. Yes. But actually some of them were quite good.
Oh, so how does it work?
Okay, so you upload onto one of the kind of paid for sites, which is costs that much, actually. And you literally just upload like 10 pictures or something. And I literally just use ones from my iPhone, so nothing special. But it's really funny because you can choose the style that you want. So you can choose sort of formal work attire or casual clothes, and you can choose the background. So you can choose to be in an office or in nature or whatever you want. So I went
could I,
for...
Could I have Marie Antoinette, do you think?
Yeah, I didn't try that. But anyway, yeah, so you do it. And then it gave... So the result was it gave me slightly more ginger hair than is my... Well, not quite so natural blonde hair, but actually I quite like the mildly more ginger look, was actually quite good. It also was very forgiving and gave me about 10 years younger look than I actually am. But also some of them, I was slightly mildly demented in my eyes in some of the options.
Do you know people have been uploading their pictures to AI and saying, how old do I look? And the AI says exactly how old they are. So first of all, people get really upset. And then they say, what can I do to improve myself? And ChatGPT tells them how much Botox to use. So I don't know about this, but anyway, were there any good ones?
There were probably 3 or 4 out of the 100 that I got that were actually kind of usable. But it was really funny because you basically see yourselves in clothes that you don't own.
I think we should post some of these in the show notes. Okay, but to get to the show notes, let's get to the point of this. We need a question. What have you got today?
Okay, so today we have got a follow-up actually from from our last episode. So if you recall, on our last episode, we were talking about who invented champagne. And do you remember that we touched on both the idea of fraudulent champagne and also other regions of the world naming their products as champagne? Yeah. So, as I said, I was chatting to somebody after the episode and they said that they found it really fascinating that sparkling wine in lots of different parts of the world was, or in some cases still is, called champagne. And as you say, somebody pointed out that they particularly loved your Russian champagne story and in particular your, as they put it, brave attempts at Russian pronunciation.
A brave attempt. That's like calling a political decision courageous, meaning it's a disaster that's about to happen.
Yeah. Or saying somebody is or something is visionary when what you mean is kind of divorced from reality.
That's right.
Anyway, that's a sort of segue into today's question from Alex, who I was having that discussion with, all about things that don't really seem what they are. So he asked, after listening to the champagne episode, how much faking of wine, or to that matter spirits, he says, actually goes on. Is it common? Might I unwittingly have consumed fake or fraudulent wine or even whiskey in the past?
Oh, goodness. That is opening up an episode, or maybe three. It's a huge question. Because there's fraud all across the chain, and we should probably talk about some of those.
Yeah. And since he asked me, so thinking about this question, I've been thinking of a way that we could frame it, because you say there's so much we could be talking about here. So like a framing or a way of classifying how we can have the discussion, because there's so many different elements to it. So I've actually ended up coming up with a sort of framework we can use.
Oh, actually, that's probably going to be very useful. So give us the framework.
Okay. So you ready for this? So I think we can divide this up into sort of three sections. So we can have, you ready? Fake, fraud, or faux, as in the French word faux, F-A-U-X. Did you get it? It's like my alliteration.
I think that's a really good idea, actually.
Other than I'm sounding like a TV game show. You know, you can say like, is this fake? No, start again. Is this fake, fraud, or faux? Gosh, that's actually quite a tongue twister.
So it's an elocution lesson at the same time.
Which I failed. Okay. And I've just realised, obviously, that faux, as in the French word, means false. So I could have just gone with fake, fraud, or false. Okay, that doesn't sound quite as good.
Faux is good. It sounds more professional.
Okay, even if I can't say it. Okay, so thank you for your support. So let's kick off then with fraud and the different types of fraud that can occur or happen in the world of wine and spirits.
Okay, so it's actually a very interesting topic and it's a vast topic. Mm. So like I said, when most people think about fraud, they're thinking about counterfeits. Yeah. So they're generally thinking of people going to enormous lengths to fake bottles of investment grade wine or spirits, which no doubt we'll get to.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of fraud is actually people passing off the products of one region as another. And historically, this was even normal. So in the past, like the 19th century past, you might find Algerian wines in Burgundy, for example. And one of the reasons that the Appalachian system grew up was actually to stop that kind of thing happening. So I should have heard that way back when it was colder, many winemakers in Europe would do sort of minor acts of fraud, like they'd add illegal amounts of sugar just before or during fermentation to get a higher level of alcohol, which is, in the scheme of things, is nothing like, you know, counterfeiting Romani Conti, but it still represents a level of fraud.
Yeah, so we should say here that we're talking about chaptalization here. So the process of adding sugar to unfermented grape juice, as you were just saying, so before the fermentation, with the purpose not to sweeten the wine, but to actually increase the alcohol content by giving the yeast more sugar to ferment into alcohol.
Yeah, that's right. But the thing is, you're allowed to do it under some circumstances, but in a very defined way. And what you're not allowed to do is go to the supermarket and buy up bags and bags of it. And so the amount allowed by law was much smaller than what people were actually adding. And apparently people have told me there was quite the art to buying sugar over separate supermarket runs, so you didn't raise anybody's suspicions. Yeah, and one of the ways you did it was you'd send your kids off to do it.
So on a sugar run.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that type of fraud has virtually disappeared, but mostly because nobody needs to use it anymore.
Well, yes. Okay. Yes-ish. So I've actually heard a story about this that actually occurring in the last couple of years.
Oh, gossip. You're going to name names?
No. No, I'm not. I'll tell you the story, but I won't name names. Okay, so I have to be very careful on the source. Anyway, so I was chatting recently.
Yeah, because you're protecting a criminal. That's not why.
So I was chatting to somebody who works in the UK wine industry, and they recounted a tale of a winemaker in Champagne who was telling them that, as you said, the amount of sugar that can be added to champagne is highly regulated. So you have to go to a sugar wholesaler so that it's recorded how much sugar you use. Anyway, this particular winemaker was saying that they did exactly what you said and made numerous trips to the supermarket to buy extra sugar so that it wasn't counted.
You can imagine this. You can imagine the supermarket in those regions. You know, they must have learned from long experience that at some times of the year to make sure the warehouse out the back is stocked with sugar.
Yeah. So if we're talking about fraud in terms of adding stuff, sugar in that case, to wine, that you're not legally permitted to do so, what other things might be added?
I judged a wine competition in Georgia a couple of years ago, and there was one wine that smelled very strongly of blackberries. Mm. So the winemaker who was on the panel actually put the wine aside, and a couple of hours later, it still smelled strongly of blackberries, and she said that it was an added flavour. Now, that's the only time I've ever come across that.
Okay, so a question then on that wine. Was that wine any good?
It's a good question. You know, on the first sip, it was because it had all these flavours, but actually after that, it tasted disgusting. Okay. I've only seen it that one time.
Mm, okay, so it might be rare now, but we shouldn't forget, obviously, the very famous adulteration scandals that have happened in the 1980s.
Oh, yeah. Good call. I'd forgotten about them. Mm. And they are extremely important. They actually changed the face of wine. Do you want to start?
Okay, yeah. So I'll kick off then. So, so the first one and probably the most infamous one was the Austrian ethylene glycol scandal in 1985. So ethylene glycol is toxic. It's a compound found in antifreeze, hence it became known as the antifreeze scandal, and was added to white wines.
And what did they add it for?
Okay, so it makes wine sweeter and adds body, so it kind of makes the wines appear like they're more higher quality sweet wines than just the ordinary wines.
And what happened? How did they discover that?
Okay, so Germany is Austria's biggest export market, and a German lab discovered the fraud during routine testing, actually. There were around, can you get this, 36 wineries involved in this, and it was clearly a major panic with supermarkets dumping the wine.
Yeah, it's all coming back to me now. You're reminding me that when I go to a formal presentation about Austrian wine, the sort, you know, where they tell you how their exports are going, they always bring this up as the start of the modern winemaking era in Austria, because it was such a trauma for them as a whole that it shook everything up. But it really made them focus on quality to try and win back market trust. And today there's almost no Austrian wine sold at that cheap end of the market. So the whole country produces high quality wines. They see the scandal as something that was terrible, but it pushed them in a completely any direction. And I think it's the fact that they're very open and honest and talk about it that makes it sound like a much bigger deal than the next scandal.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk away? Tell us about the next scandal.
Yeah. Well, this is one that probably should be talked about more than it is as a grim warning. So in the 1986, actually, some producers in Italy added wood alcohol or methanol to cheap bulk wines to try and raise the alcohol level. Now, methanol is deadly, and 23 people died while dozens more were injured. And one of the other things methanol will do is it doesn't kill you or ruin your kidneys. It will send you blind.
Gosh.
And it did, permanently blind.
Wow.
So the press ended up calling it vino de morte or wine of death.
Yeah, it's shocking, shocking incident that happened there, really. But it, as you were saying earlier about Austrian wines and the kind of increase in quality as a result of that, it pushed Italy towards a higher quality of production at that time.
Yeah. It made consumers want DOC and DOCG wines. And it also pushed the authorities to really crack down on traceability. And the other thing is today there's a big focus on estate bottling, which wasn't so widespread back then.
Yeah. So we should also say that this type of fraud goes on still and can occur in spirits as well. So where there's bootlegging, you know, bootleggers might be adding methanol, as you were talking about earlier, which is found in lots of household products, to drinks, to spirits, to make them more alcoholic than they are. So just a sidebar, we should note here that methanol and ethanol are chemically related, actually very similar to each other. But as you were saying earlier, the outcome for human beings imbibing them is hugely different on the human body. So methanol is the simplest alcohol, just with one carbon atom, whereas ethanol has two, but they're very close from a chemical compound point of view. And as you were saying, if ingested, methanol at certain levels can kill you, make you blind. But it's not uncommon even today for tourists to find this at their cost.
Yeah, and the blindness shouldn't be underestimated. I read a story actually quite recently about a girl who'd drunk a cocktail or something while she was on holiday, and when she woke up the next morning, she couldn't see. She asked people in the room to open the curtains, and that's when she realised she couldn't see, and she's never recovered her sight. So this typically happens in places where alcohol is either banned or heavily restricted, or they don't have very good food and alcohol laws. So every few years there are outbreaks of deaths in Russia where alcohol is strictly controlled because somebody will put fake vodka on the market. But then in countries like Indonesia, particularly Vietnam and Laos, where the sort of the backpacker route, it often happens because there aren't enough controls on food and drink.
Yeah, and we shouldn't forget also that six tourists died in November 2024 in Laos recently, you know, only a matter of months ago.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, there's a guy called Colin Ahern, and he's an Australian who runs a Facebook page called Just Don't Drink Spirits and Barley, which collects stories about methanol poisoning and calls for warnings because he had methanol poisoning, and the stories that he posts are just absolutely harrowing.
Goodness me, it's extraordinary that needs to be done, isn't it? So how do people avoid being poisoned?
Is really clear. Do not drink any alcohol unless it comes from a commercially branded bottle that is still sealed and you see somebody unseal it in front of you. So if it's a sealed bottle of Bacardi, it's fine. But if it's a name you don't recognise or it comes from a plastic bottle or it's from a bottle that might say Bacardi on the front but could be reused, don't touch it. And the other thing is avoid cocktails. This is obviously if you're backpacking or off the beaten trail. If you're at a bar or in a hotel at a major city, it's a different thing.
Yeah, and you were talking about earlier, can you tell immediately if you've consumed methanol?
No, and this is the awful thing. Sometimes the symptoms don't set in for a while after people have gone to bed. But the rule is if you start to feel dizzy or nauseous or your sight goes blurry, get to a hospital immediately.
Yeah.
Even if you think you're going to be embarrassed because you'll have to tell them you drank too much, just get to a hospital.
Yeah. And the you were saying that the unopened bottle bit is really, really important because a lot of fake spirits are poured into real bottles and then sold as the real thing, and that can particularly happen off the sort of beaten track in tourist places.
When I was in South Africa last year, a South African executive told me that their warehouse had been broken into and a pallet of spirits was stolen, and they were freaking about what might end up in those bottles once they were empty.
Yeah.
So you know, obviously the true danger is to the person who ends up drinking illicit spirits, but that will still hurt the brand owner as well if it's, you know, a bottle of their brand and stuff that's killing people.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we talked there about fraud from a sort of criminal, dangerous, or at least deeply damaging perspective. Let's move on to my second one, fake. So wines and spirits that pretend to be something they're not, and often for the case of
profit. So this is the fun section of the podcast.
Yes, yeah. Fun. So, well, fun, it depends whether you've been caught out in one of these or not. So let's talk about Rudy Canard one.
No, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I might have the pronunciation wrong.
Well, he pronounces it as Rudy Canard one. Rudy Canarwin. So let's go with
Canarwin. Yeah. Anyway, the most infamous, probably, wine counterfeiter in modern history. So
indeed.
His story is he comes to the US from Indonesia in the 1990s to study in the US and applies for asylum in 2001. It's denied. And he's supposed to leave by 2003. But he stays illegally in the US.
So he's clearly got criminal tendencies right from the start.
Pretty much. So by the early 2000s, he's hosting extravagant wine tastings and spending up to $1 million a month on rare bottles of wine. He even, get this, earns the nickname Dr. Conti for his obsession with Romani Conti. So in 2006, he partners with Acker, Murrell and Condit, and they host two blockbuster auctions, The Cellar and The Cellar 2, get the naming on that one. Really thought about that, didn't they? But they rake in.
They were thinking about the cash, Lulu.
Yes, not the naming. And they, do you know what? They raked in more than $35 million dollars combined in those two auctions.
Well, you know, the cash is the interesting thing, you know. Didn't anybody wonder where he was getting it from?
So he claims his family is wealthy, but two uncles on his mother's side are convicted already of major fraud. One even disappears and is still on the run, supposedly, allegedly. Anyway, he is also borrowing cash. You talked about cash pretty heavily at this point.
Okay, so when did all... So he's doing tastings for rich people. He's selling off bottles at auction. He's buying like crazy.
Yep.
When does it all start to fall apart?
So in 2009, billionaire Bill Koch sues him over fake bottles, and that brings us to the Jefferson wine scandal.
Yes, Bill Koch. That's a name that comes up in a couple of wine scandals. So the other one was there was this guy called Hardy Rodenstock, who was a German collector, and he was very, very good at tracking down rare bottles. You know, people would tell him stuff, and he'd go and find amazing things. And so he claimed that he'd been given a tip-off about a collection in Paris that was behind a wall, which he went and had a look at and discovered that there was a whole bunch of 18th century bottles behind the wall. And some of them were supposedly owned by Thomas Jefferson, who was a great lover of French wine. So one thing led to another, and there's the German way of saying it's Koch. How did you say it?
I said coach. Koch. Koch. No, I didn't say coach. I said Koch. Bill. Shall we just call him Bill?
Bill. Yeah, right. For Bill from now on. So yeah. Bill is a great collector of wines, and he bought some of these Rodenstock bottles through intermediaries and intermediaries that he really, you know, that were very trustworthy. But he took them to Monticello, which was Jefferson's estate, and the experts took a look at the records and they said, no, these bottles have nothing to do with Jefferson.
Okay. So speaking of Jefferson and Monticello, can I tell a quick story?
Oh, yeah, go on.
Okay, so it's just a small one. Okay, so we visited Monticello about 10 years ago as a family. So our kids would have been like 12 and 16. So, you know, classic drag the kids around cultural family outing. Anyway, it was sweltering hot because it was high summer in Virginia. And we had this volunteer guide in a kind of guide group. Let's just say she was very passionate about Monticello. So she was very lovely, but she was the kind of person who would talk for 10 minutes like about a wooden chair that Jefferson had once sat on. She was very earnest, very detailed, and shall we say quite slow.
Yeah, I used to live in Virginia, so I know how hot it can get. So what happened?
Okay, so after about four rooms of what felt like the very deep dive into every nail in the place, I can say my kids and I hit what we now refer to in our family as a Monticello moment.
Yes. What's the Monticello moment?
So it is now our lexicon for, it's the point where you quietly realise I've had enough and I need to escape.
Oh, it's not, I'm trapped in a UNESCO World Heritage Site. I need to get out of here.
Well, sort of, yes. So we spotted an emergency exit between the corridor room, so clearly modern health and safety at work, and we quietly slipped out, the kids and I, into the sunshine. But the only problem, there was a big problem, my husband hadn't realised that we weren't really enjoying the tour. He really was, and he didn't notice, and then we had to stand outside and wait for him for an hour while he finished off the tour.
And does he bring up little Thomas Jefferson anecdotes every so often?
Yes. Yeah, so now in our family, Monticello moment is shorthand for ducking out of something at the moment if it becomes too unbearable. Anyway, let's move
on. We'll put it in the show notes. Okay.
Anyway, so back to fake wines. So what happened to Jefferson's wines?
Okay, supposed so in 2006, Bill took Mr. Rodenstock to court, or he tried to. So Rodenstock was a German citizen and he lived in Germany, and he claimed that a US court had no jurisdiction over him. So Bill never got his judgment against Rodenstock. But it was an amazing story. I mean, it just involved everything, billionaires, Thomas Jefferson. So a writer called Benjamin Wallace wrote a book about the whole thing called The Billionaire's Vinegar. And as soon as that came out, people started suing one another. So wine auctioneer Michael Broadbent in the UK sued Random House for the way he'd been portrayed, and then Bill sued an auction house, and then other people came out of the woodworks claiming that other Rodenstock wines were counterfeit. It was a mess.
Absolute mess. As you say, so many counter suing and more suing going on. But were the wines definitely fake? Was that kind of proved?
Well, according to NPR, one of the tests that was done was they took one of the, you know, Jefferson in inverted bottles underground to track the gamma rays coming from the bottle. So here's the thing. If the wine was bottled before 1945, it couldn't have any cesium-137 in it, because 1945 is the year of the atomic bomb, and apparently that fallout is everywhere.
Okay, so I'm not really sure I'm pleased you've told me that. So you're basically saying that if it was pre-1945, then they would have been able to work that out from this cesium.
From a lack of cesium,
yeah. lack of cesium,
and
yeah.
The thing was, the bottle didn't have cesium-137 in it, but it was definitely old. But Bill still didn't believe the wines were real. So he was like, never get on the bad side of this guy. He was relentless, and he hired investigators. And eventually they tracked down the people in Germany who claimed to have engraved the bottles. And they'd used, because the important thing about the bottles was they had a capital T, small h, capital J, which was the Thomas Jefferson thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, so these people claimed that they had engraved that on the bottles, and they'd used a modern dentist tool.
Seriously. So was he arrested in the end?
No, because there's no proof that he did it. And I should say that right up until his death in 2018, he would sue anybody in the German media who suggested otherwise. And I, in fact, know somebody who got sued.
Ah, okay. So going back to Rudy then, who was having these lavish tastings with his rich friends, I guess he crossed the wrong person then when he sold the fakes to our friend Bill.
He sure did, because I'm sure Bill was bloody annoyed about the whole wine thing by then. So Bill sued him in 2009. But he wasn't the only person who was beginning to be suspicious. Other people were beginning to raise the alarm about Kanawin and his bottles by then. And so various people, various estates began contacting auction houses to say these bottles are probably fake.
Yeah, and I remember that because the biggest mistake was trying to sell one of the infamous mistakes from Domaine Ponceau from Burgundy. So he was selling vintages ranging from 1945, one of his favourite years, clearly, to 1971. Anyway, Laurent Ponceau, so the head of the Domaine, was contacted by the FBI, and he had a meeting with an agent in New York who asked him like loads of questions about the bottles. There was a bit of a problem, though. The Domaine hadn't started making those wines until 1982.
Oh, see, Rudy Kanawin was just working at the wrong time. Imagine if he'd had ChatGPT. He could have found that out.
In one flurry. Five seconds.
That's right. He'd still be at his game.
I know. So anyway, so one thing led to another, and the FBI turned up at his house in 2020. And you know what? They discovered...
No, they didn't. I think it was earlier than that. I think it was...
Oh, sorry, 2012. Apologies. Right. Sorry, I should have said 2012. You're right. Thank you for correcting me. Anyway, so they turned up his house in 2012. 12. And what they discovered was like this whole counterfeiting factory going on. So he was turning Napa wines into rare Bordeaux and lesser Burgundies into rare vintages. And he would buy up lots of Burgundies that actually were quite good wines, but just not the even tippy-top ones he was claiming they were.
So was he also making labels and corks and stuff, or was he getting empty bottles that he refilled?
Well, so one way it is alleged that he was doing it was to order expensive wines in restaurants and then ask for the empty bottles as a souvenir post-consumption.
That's really interesting. So I've been to tastings of famous wines and I've been told that now they smash the empty bottles afterwards to stop them
for this reason,
the counterfeit.
Yeah.
And the big houses now scour eBay looking for empty bottles that might, you know, end up in the hands of counterfeiters. Anyway, so what happened to Carnarvon?
Okay, so he was tried in the US in 2013, and the court case happened as it was at the same time a vintage was going on in France, so some of the witnesses had to appear by video.
It's a trial by Zoom.
Yeah, indeed. He got sentenced to 10 years and then he gets deported in 2021. And there is a documentary that's been made about it called, appropriately, Sour Grapes, if you want to see the full saga.
Yeah, I mean, the big question that I've always thought about this is how he managed to do it, because he was sharing wines with collectors who were used to drinking the absolute best of the best. And so I think he must have been exceptionally talented at blending and tasting to have got away with it.
So almost like this amazing skill that you sort of don't want somebody to have. But Maureen Downey, so it's, as you know, is probably the world's expert on wine counterfeit and has worked with the FBI on this. So she told American Public Radio that, and I quote, Carnarvon's kitchen was literally a factory for making counterfeit wine. He had recipes written on bottles in his kitchen. So, for example, I carry on quoting her, his recipe for the 1945 Mouton Rothschild said 1/2 1988 Pichon Melon, 1/4 oxidized Bordeaux and 1/4 Napa Cab.
Wow. I mean, imagine if this guy had used his talents for good, not evil. Yeah. He would have ended up being one of the world's great, you know, champagne blenders with an ability like that. Anyway, I've actually talked to Maureen about this, and although Carnarvon got a very harsh sentence, like a really harsh sentence, as his lawyer said at the time, there are people who do violent crimes who don't get 10-year sentences. So Maureen gets frustrated in general. She says the authorities don't take wine counterfeiting seriously because it's seen primarily as a rich person problem, but it is the equivalent of forging great art.
Yeah. And Maureen also thinks there's a lot of fake wine still in circulation, according to her. So that's why she set up her company to authenticate wines and train people in how to spot fakes.
Yeah, this is still a very, very sensitive subject. So I was moderating on a panel on wine fraud some years ago.
Of course you were, Felicity. You moderate a panel on everything to do with wine.
Well, that's right. Well, this must have been about the time that, you know, people were selling a lot of wine to China. And of course, there was a lot of counterfeiting going on in China. So we're having a discussion about it. But, you know, there were people from chateaus in the audience and they didn't want any suggestion that their wines were being counterfeited. So somebody in the audience got up and said that a huge percentage of wines that are circulating at the sort of fine wine end were fake. And at that point,
quite brave statement.
People started shouting at one another. So I let this go because I quite like drama. But the woman up in the back was making slashing throats, you know, gestures going, shut this down. But I tell you what was funny though, afterwards the CEO of one of Bordeaux's top classified growths told me that he'd been at a tasting in China where his wines were being served and they were clearly counterfeit. But he said whoever the fraudster was, he'd done a great job.
Oh my goodness me. Maybe you should be employing him as well.
Yeah, that's right. And
of course, this just doesn't happen in wine. It happens in spirits as well, this counterfeiting.
Look, I'm sure it does, but I actually don't know very much about spirits and fraud.
Oh, okay. So there's so many cases we could talk about here, but particularly happens in whiskey, partly because like in fine wine, premium whiskey can command such a high price. So maybe I'll talk about the infamous case of the single glass of Macallan 1878 that cost a small fortune and turned out to be a fake. Okay, so in this case, it was a fake, but was unknowingly sold rather than deliberately sold as a fraud that we'd been talking about earlier. So back in 2017, a Chinese wine writer was vacationing in St. Moritz in Switzerland. So he walks into a bar, it's like a man walks into a bar, at the Waldhaus Hotel MZ and pays, get this, 9,999 Swiss francs. So, as you know, that's about $10,000 for a single dram, a glass of what was claimed to be Macallan 1878. So that made it the world's most expensive scotch ever sold by the glass.
Okay, so speaking as a wine writer, what jumps out at me about this story is not the fraud. It's the fact that there is a wine writer who can go on vacation in St. Moritz and then go to the bar and say, yes, I'll have that shot for $10,000. That's what's fundamentally wrong with this story.
When you're travelling as a journalist, Felicity, and you walk into a bar.
I hope they gave him a gold-plated ice cube as well.
I don't know about that, but this is where it gets really murky. So clearly experts started raising eyebrows and questioning.
At the wine writer staying in St. Moritz or at the whiskey?
At the whiskey.
Oh, okay.
Well, maybe
focusing on the wrong thing, of course.
Yeah. So the hotel sent the whiskey off for tasting to the University of Oxford, where it was carbon dated. So they used that to try and date the whiskey. And they concluded that the whiskey was actually produced somewhere between 1970 and 1972.
So this also tells me that this wine writer is not just able to order $10,000, but he's experienced enough in ordering expensive stuff that he knows this isn't the real thing.
There's a lot of questions I've got about this story.
Okay. But anyway, basically the whiskey was 100 years out by date.
Yeah. And it got worse. Okay. So there was further testing done by labs.
What? The honeymoon suite wasn't available to the guy?
And so it turned out the whiskey was a blend. So it was around 60% malt and 40% grain. So not even a pure single malt as it was advertised. So as I said, in this case, it was, you know, not the seller that, you know, that was fraudulent, because the hotel really did believe that the whiskey was genuine. And to their credit, the Waldhaus Hotel, so they acted really swiftly. And their manager, guess this, flew all the way to Asia to refund the writer of his $10,000 purchase.
Do you think I should be plying my trade in China? I feel like I've taken a wrong turn.
Well, you should maybe
somewhere.
Move from wine to spirits more, Felicity. Clearly, it's been more lucrative for you.
Maybe. I'm rethinking my whole life trajectory. Okay, so the point is that the auction houses and the famous merchants have got very, very good at spotting fakes now, because nobody wants to have to fly to Shanghai to hand over cash. So Canalwin was working just on the cusp of wine becoming a valuable investment. And so he was, so the auction house in America really took off in the 90s, and that's when you start to see the prices begin to go up. But people weren't thinking about fraud as much as they are now. Mm. And so, but now they're really, really thinking about it. So Maureen, for example, has done training in papermaking.
Oh, wow.
So she knows if the paper used for the label is old or not and how the paper was made. Mm. So, you know, authenticators now are very, very good at checking, you know, first of all, did the vintage exist?
Oh, that's a good start. ChatGPT, our friend, can help
on that. And maybe the trail of where the bottles ended up and, you know, how the printing on the label was done, the corks, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, so talking of authentication then, so you're just mentioning it there, can we briefly talk about how the wine industry is pushing back on this as well? So one name that stands out to me is LiveX, so the London-based wine exchange. So kind of think of it as like the sort of stock market for fine wine.
It is a professional-only platform where serious bottles change hands, and it's a fantastic company.
Exactly, and it is. And you'll be pleased to know, Felicity, that I take this, as you know, podcast very seriously, and I did my homework. So I got in touch with Jessica Dunn, who is the authentication manager. Why am I struggling with that? Authentication manager, to ask how they handle risks of fakes. So, you know, really serious for them. So first of all potential members go through a really strict vetting process, because they're allowed to trade before they're allowed to trade. So this kind of like isn't an eBay where anybody can jump on.
It's an incredible vetting process, actually.
Yeah, it is. And they also use text. So LiveX has a custom algorithm that flags high-risk wines, triggering more detailed checks by their trained warehouse team.
Yeah, so they have a lot of expertise in this as well.
Yeah. So it's really forensic. And if something looks off, they bring in Michael Egan, so an expert, independent expert, who literally wrote the book on wine fraud, and he helps inspect suspect bottles and advise on protocols.
That name is familiar. I think he testified in the Canawian trial.
Yeah, I believe he did. I think you're right on that. Yeah, and then LiveX also has this visual archive of thousands of bottles, photos, labels, capsules, and even case markings, so that they can spot inconsistencies. So through their network of producers and merchants and specialists, you know, they go through this regular training. And as I said at the beginning, they employ a dedicated They also employ a dedicated authentication manager, Jessica herself, who also happens to be a lawyer.
Yes, person who wrote in about my Russian pronunciation, in about that.
Yes. Thank you. Just throw me under the bus, why don't you?
Yeah, that's right. But actually, this whole thing about getting rid of things is really important. I walked into a warehouse in Germany once, and they had all these cartons for things like Petrus, and I actually took one, which has now got my shoe shining stuff in it. No, with permission.
Oh, I looked at it and went, that's a good size.
But it was kind of a sign of their naivety that they gave it to me, because normally these things are destroyed.
Yeah.
But anyway, going back to LiveX, they've got very serious infrastructure around this.
Yeah, and exactly, and it clearly, because it's so important to them. So before we move on, let's pause, summarise what we've covered in response to Alex's question about wine and spirits fraud so far.
Yeah, okay, we should, because it's been a lot. It's a lot more than just a few dodgy bottles. And your fake fraud or faux system has actually helped make sense of it all.
Okay, I'm very proud. Carry on.
And you should be. Right, let's start with fraud. So fraud is deliberate and illegal action. So we talked about the Austrian antifreeze scandal and the Italian methanol tragedy, which is both cases where additives were used to manipulate wine, and in the worst instances, they cost lives.
Yeah, and sadly, methanol poisoning and counterfeit spirit remains a real issue today, particularly in some parts of Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe where regulation is limited.
That's right. Then we've got fake, purposeful counterfeiting, often for profit. Rudy Canawian is the best known case. He faked rare wines and sold them at auction. But it intersects with the famous Jefferson bottle story. Old bottles supposedly linked to Thomas Jefferson, likely fabricated.
And then we discussed how some parts of the industry are fighting back. So LiveX, for example, has its systems in place of vetting and algorithms and flag risks, and working with independent experts to verify bottles along with teams of authentication experts. So have you got any more other examples up your sleeve of a fraud or fake stories that we should add before we move on to faux?
This is a bit like the equivalent of sitting in a haunted house telling ghost stories, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the only reason I ask is because I know you, Flisty, and I'm sure you've got some good ones up your sleeve.
Well, it's funny you bring it up, because when I was editor of Minding Us Magazine, people were always telling me about fraud, and sometimes I get really cross and frustrated that I didn't follow up, because most fraud happens at the lower levels of the market, not at the fine wine end. So it's things like the white wine trucked in across the border from Slovenia that gets an Italian label on it, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you brought this up. As you say, it's not just the high-end wine and spirits that are subject to fraud or fake. It also happens to extensively, some would say, at the lower end of the market, and probably much more often than we would be aware of or talking about. So why don't you do one of your stories? I think it's right up your alley. Why didn't you do more of this writing then when you had those opportunities?
Look, if I'd had the resources of the BBC or the New York Times, I absolutely would have. That's right. But you know, it's actually really difficult to prove. And typically you have to follow a truck going from one country to another, and then you have to convince whistleblowers to talk to you. You have to try and get pictures of the paperwork. Or if you can't do that, you have to take samples and try and get them chemically analysed, which is really expensive. But I will say my German colleagues at a magazine called Weinwirtschaft, which is a trade magazine, would regularly comb Italian court documents. And that way they turned up plenty of interesting cases. Yeah, because there's a lot of organised crime involvement in counterfeiting. And so the authorities are always raiding people.
Okay, so did you ever publish one of these stories?
Yeah, when I could. I mean, we ran a story in 2020 about winemakers who were blending grapes from lower quality production into wines that were labelled DOC, and then they were adding sugar and water. Basically, they were doing it to artificially increase the amount of wine and then get a premium price for it.
Okay, so so the Italian police take these things quite seriously then, saying?
They really do. Let me tell you how seriously they take it. So when I first arrived in Europe, so this is about 2008, the authorities announced they were sending Carabinieri, the police, to train as sommeliers so they could work undercover in restaurants.
Oh my goodness, that's hilarious. So you get like two training careers in one, so that if one doesn't work out, if you're not very good in the police, you've got a second career as a sommelier. That's great. I've not heard that before.
Yeah, that's right. So you'd think that was a great story. I thought that was a great story. So when I heard about it, I did my usual thing of contacting all the wine writers in Italy I knew, and I asked them to do the story. But you know what they said? They said it's summer, and they all said, "Well, we'll get on to it in September." And this was like the end of June or something. So in frustration, I eventually rang a friend of mine who worked for what was then the Decanter News Service, and she did the story and it went viral.
Of course it did. So you've told us about the Italians. I think you should mention, or we should mention also, that cheap bulk wines often end up in Eastern Europe under fake French and Italian labels.
Yes. And actually, we should talk about one story that was widely reported because it was internationally. It was the faking of Pinot Noir for Gallo. So Gallo is the biggest wine company in the US, and they had a French brand called, which I think they still do, called Red Bicyclette.
Bicyclette. Yeah. I'll pronounce that one for you. There you go. Have that one for free. Bicyclette.
I can see our inbox is just getting bigger and bigger. Anyways, the wine for that was from the south of France. So, but what happened was that in 2008, there were some auditors in the region, and they noticed that Decasse wine merchants, who were the intermediary, had been buying very large volumes of Pinot Noir for about two-thirds of its normal price. And not only that, but it suddenly turned out there was apparently more Pinot Noir being produced in the region than was normal.
Okay, so I take it this is because it wasn't Pinot Noir, the wine.
That's correct. So Decasse wine merchants were buying Merlot and Shiraz, which is a lot less valuable. They were buying from about eight different cooperatives and then rebadging it as Pinot Noir, selling it to the intermediary who packaged it for Gallo.
Okay, but surely it must have tasted really different because the flavour profile of Merlot versus Shiraz versus Pinot Noir is really different.
Oh, Luli, that tells me you have not drunk enough cheap wine in your life.
What are you saying?
At the commodity end, so Pinot Noir, especially if it comes from warm regions, just tastes like a dry red. It's really difficult to taste the difference.
Okay, so it's my homework to go and really cheap Pinot Noir. Okay, I promise. A bit like you and your Guinness, I promise I will go and drink. I will find the cheapest Pinot Noir I can and report back to you. Anyway, back to the story. So what happened in the end?
Oh, there were lots of fines. Everybody was embarrassed. There was lots of bad publicity for Gallo, for the region. But according to the Guardian, did a story on it. According to them, the sales of all this cheap wine was a godsend for the growers who at the time were struggling to compete with the New World wines. And I quote, one of the accused, a cooperative head, told a local newspaper, La Depeche, quote, "We would have put Yoplait on the wine if they'd asked us to." All right, now it's your turn for a story.
That's a direct quote.
Yeah, that's right.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Okay, so no story about wine fraud is complete without a reference we should do to the case of Spanish bulk wine being passed off as French.
Oh, right, yeah, okay, this is a big one.
Yeah. So between 2016 and 2019, around 380,000 cases of Spanish wine were trucked into France and sold as prestigious Bordeaux. So even including names like Go and Pomerol, one lawyer called it fraud on an industrial scale.
Which actually supports my other theory, which is
okay, you have another theory.
Yeah, most Cabernets, if they're not the high end, taste pretty similar no matter where they come from.
Okay, again, we will get lots in our inbox.
Unless they come from a very cold climate.
Yes, okay. So it all started, this case, after a poor 2013 harvest in Bordeaux. So to fill a gap, a sales manager turned to a négociant who quietly bought Spanish wine.
Yeah, and French growers, of course, have long resented Spanish wine because it's cheaper. The labour costs are much cheaper in Spain, and of course, it eats into a very significant section of their market.
Yeah. In this case, the transport documents were faked, and the labels changed along the chain. So by the time the bottles were ready for the shelves, they looked like legit Bordeaux.
So how did they work out that it was fraudulent?
Okay, for a while they didn't, and then the whole scheme got unravelled when investigators stumbled across a sort of dodgy wine label printing equipment while they were investigating something completely different. Actually, it was an unrelated drug case.
Yeah, I mean, this actually comes to Maureen's point about people not taking wine fraud seriously enough, is that at this kind of commodity end, quite often it's not just wine fraud, it's part of a constellation of organised crime.
Yeah, exactly. And so in this case, officials linked it back to the 2013 harvest shortfall. And in this case, the negociant even admitted to bringing Spanish wine. And he said, apparently, quote, that his priority was turnover and margin. So, you know, that's what he was after. And he even said that. So five people were actually eventually convicted in this case.
Yeah, and as we previously noted, there's a lot of counterfeiting of cheap spirits as well. But the difference is that when it's done in wine, you're just generally, drinking cheap wine, whereas in spirits, you could be drinking something deadly.
Yeah. So we have to stop on stories now, Felicity, on fake or fraud. Otherwise, we could be here all day and we could end up trying to outstory each other. So let's move on to faux, reminding ourselves and our listeners that we're using the word faux here, F-A-U-X, French as in false.
Oh, I like the word faux. I think that's a great word. Let's stick to that, definitely.
Okay. So when it comes to faux, when we're talking about faux wines, false wines, is it mainly just, you were talking earlier there about kind of blending cheaper wines to pass them off as more expensive wines?
Well, funnily enough, I suppose we should define faux as people who are piggybacking off somebody else but not doing anything illegal. Is that a good definition?
Yeah, and more eloquent and better than mine, as always.
Yeah, okay, so there have been a couple of, this is just almost trivia at this point, but there's been a couple of attempts at making what you might call better wines through chemistry.
Okay.
So these definitely fall into the faux category. So back in 2016, and yes, I did stories about this.
Oh, yeah,
back in 2016, there were a couple of biotechnology graduates in San Francisco who decided to analyze the chemistry of wine and then
Like, when you're doing kind of veggie burger type thing,
Impossible burger. Well, what they were trying to do, their goal was to replicate Dom Perignon
so that
you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. They called themselves AVA Winery and their first attempt was a Moscato d'Asti.
Okay, so effectively like a sort of fashion knockoff. You buy the real thing and then you take it apart at the seams.
Yeah, that's right. It's exactly what they did.
Okay, so what was the goal? Was it to sell replicas that tasted the same? So basically faux, false, that we were talking about?
Well, yes, but they actually had this really big goal. So I talked to them and they thought that farming was bad for the planet
and it would be
better to replicate everything chemically. So they were starting with wine as their proof of concept.
Okay, that's so deeply weird. So we would basically all end up eating food out of vats like in Jetsons. So how far did they go?
Well, okay, so I did that story not quite 10 years ago and I can't find any evidence of them on the web anymore. So I guess it didn't work out.
Okay, so even if it is it now chemically possible to copy wine, do we think?
Well, I spoke to some scientists who said in theory, yes, but the problem with wine is that scientists still don't know how it works chemically. So they don't even really understand problems like astringency from tannins very well. So they'd be up against the you don't know what you don't know problem. But here's what's interesting. One of the people I spoke to was chemist Dr. Bill Simpson, and he told me there's a very famous German chemist called Professor Dr. Peter Schieberle, who's famous for getting his PhD students to go to the supermarket, pick a product and then replicate it.
Oh.
And Dr. Simpson said in his own lab, they've already replicated beer.
Really? So they've managed to do it with beer?
Yeah, he said it was like an Elvis impersonator. Those were his exact words. He said it's close to the real thing, but not the real thing.
Okay, so this is where I fess up that I've seen an Elvis impersonator in Las Vegas.
You know, the closest I've come to that is I worked with a woman who was married in Las Vegas by an Elvis impersonator.
Okay, I'm not sure I should say this, but when I said I've seen one, I've had an Elvis impersonator in Vegas actually renew our wedding vows on Office Wedding.
Do you know what, Lily? Now I don't feel so bad about confessing up to how well I know cheap wine.
Oh, Oh, why do I do this, Felicity? It's your fault. I've confessed things to you. Anyway, any reputational, professional reputation I had and any dignity is now rapidly waning. So, go back to the story.
Moving right along, back to what Dr. Simpson said, if people wanted to replicate popular wines, he thought they could do it, but they should start off with a base wine and then add specific chemicals.
Okay. And has anybody ever tried that you're
aware of?
They
have. I'm glad you asked. So about the same period that AVA Winery was thinking about this, there was a wine company called Replica Wines in Colorado.
Well, that's a good name for a company that does that.
That's right. But they made knockoffs of popular brands like the Prisoner. But the thing is, they didn't pretend they were making the actual Prisoner. It was more like a perfume dupe. And they called the wines things like knockoff. And they were like half the price of the brands they were copying. But I will say they're another company that seems to have vanished.
Okay. So the first problem I can see with this model is that there's so much wine around in the world. Surely it must just be cheaper to buy real wine on the bulk market rather than sort of trying to chemically make wine.
Yeah, exactly. And I throw these in as fun examples, not as a serious part of the faux market.
Yeah. Okay. So we've covered some interesting examples, as you said just there, of faux wine from a product point of view. But can we also now talk about faux branding?
I think we must. This is a good topic.
Okay. So, well, you being a fan, as we know, super fan, as you've confessed, I really need to bring this up to make me not feel so bad, about Lidl, of Lidl and Aldi, you'll be really aware of this one, Felicity.
Lidl, I won't hear a word against them. Are you suggesting that Lidl sells faux products, Lily?
No, sort of, but other retailers do too. So what I'm thinking about here is an area that's generated a lot of heat, but not necessarily a lot of headlines, which is supermarket-owned label wines and spirits that bear a striking resemblance to well-known brands.
Yes. So this is where the bottle and contents look very familiar, but the name isn't quite what you would expect.
Yeah, that's the one exactly. So I've looked into this quite closely, actually. So especially back when I was running Wine Intelligence, we actually, of some projects we did, was gathering consumer evidence about, you know, do consumers really get confused between the brands? And what the evidence did show us that was absolutely yes. When you've got these very adjacent brands that look and feel and sound really similar, and particularly when you're shopping, you know, you're not paying so much attention, you're going on those kind of bigger, immediate, fast brain cues that we've talked about before, that absolutely people genuinely kind of got muddled up or believe they were buying the so-called original brand.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by this. So last year I had a conversation with a category manager from a Dutch supermarket. Mm-hmm. She's retired now, but it was her job to buy wine and spirits for a major chain in Holland. And she told me they would regularly take big brands to a distiller and get those brands analysed and then copied. And she said there was only one time they weren't able to copy something. It was some coffee liqueur that had been made in a very tricky way, but everything else was just knocked off.
Yeah, and there are so many examples of this. So let's just take two that have occurred in Sainsbury's, so it's a mainstream supermarket in the UK that, you know, sells a high proportion in our country, in the UK, of both wine and spirits. So they have put two products onto their shelves in the past. One was called Villetta. So it looked remarkably like Villa Maria. Sort of sounds along that line. So same font of family font, similar gold bordered label, even a red winged logo. So Villa Maria complained that it was confusing customers.
I'm not surprised. Okay, so what else?
So there was one Camino del Angel, which looked remarkably similar to Casillero del Diablo. So the same Gothic style of font, Spanish name, and a near identical bottle silhouette. And it caused a stir because Sainsbury's at the time then dropped Casillero del Diablo from the shelf and replaced it with this wine whilst they were still selling Casillero online.
That's a bit scuzzy, actually. I imagine the brand wasn't thrilled.
I can imagine so. So there's been all sorts, so many cases of this. So there was Aldi's, Rosalie, a pale rosé in a soft pink bottle that drew immediately similar comparisons to Kylie Minogue's rosé. So Kylie's team hinted at legal action on this.
See,
one.
This is why I shop at Lidl, not Aldi. You wouldn't catch Lidl messing with Kylie's wines. That's just sacrilege.
I know, you could never do that. But as you are not an Aldi shopper. As you're admitting there, you might not remember Aldi's light up gin bottle. So the one that mirrored the M&S's Christmas gin that had sort of these LED lights bottle, light up bottle with snowfall flake stuff going on around the bottle. And M&S took them to court and won.
All right. Has one of these things ever turned up on your Christmas tree, Lily?
Adjacent.
I'm not sure we should put this podcast episode out for public consumption. Okay, so both of our reputations ruined in 1 hour. Okay, so with all of these, you know, these copycats, what's going on? Is it just copying? I mean, why do they do it rather than just...
Well, it's back to this fast brain stuff, you know, where we shop, where we navigate the world as much as we can in our fast brain, which is that kind of immediate brand recognition. So it's a marketing tactic or strategy, we could say. So the retailers want to create a halo effect, so their version looks like the real thing. So they're playing with the DBAs, the distinctive brand assets that I've talked about before, but it costs less. So many consumers, especially if you're in a rush, grab a lookalike, often without realizing it's not the so-called original.
Yeah, so I take it in a legal sense, it's not fraud. No. In a moral sense, it probably is, but this is what we would put in our category of faux.
Exactly, which is why it comes into this kind of grey area. It's legal, but just barely in some cases that have been proved in court. But as many people buying wine and spirits in supermarkets, these visual cues really matter, especially when brands have spent decades investing in building up their brand recognition and reputation.
Yeah, David Ogilvy, the advertising guru, once said, "Imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but it is also the biggest threat to brand identity." Mm. And I guess he was right.
Yeah. And it raises an important question, which I guess is, when does inspired by become a copy and cross that line legally? So, Felicity, I think that brings us full circle. So we started with Alex's question, how much faking goes on in wine and spirits? And I think the answer is more than most people realise.
Yeah, and probably in ways they don't realise. So we've got life-threatening methanol in spirits, which is relatively common. Dodgy sugar runs in champagne, done by somebody who apparently shall remain nameless.
Yes, they will.
And supermarket bottles that look just a little bit too familiar.
Yeah, which is why we like our classification, fake, fraud or faux, and why it's been useful. So recapping, fraud is the criminal stuff. So the toxic additives we were talking about, tampering and illegal activities. Fake is deliberately counterfeiting. So when wine and spirits that claim to be something they're not. And then we have faux, which is the greyer zone, misleading, but not always illegal.
Yeah, and importantly, these things happen at every level of the market. And as we've seen, they should be taken seriously because they can intersect with organised crime. But we'd also should highlight one thing that we haven't talked about is we haven't talked about wine and spirits investment fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, to mention that. And that's because partly it's such a huge topic in and of itself. So we are going to cover that in a future episode where we'll just focus on investment fraud in wine and spirits. So for the purposes of this episode, what we have covered here, the good news is that our industry is getting better at catching these things, whether it's professional authenticators or just consumers becoming more aware.
Yeah, so maybe the best answer to Alex's question is you might have had a fake or a fraud or a faux drink at some point, but now you're going to know how to spot it.
Yeah, and if nothing else, we've learned to watch out for unscrewed or opened bottles, supermarket tributes and $10,000 drams of scotch.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of A Question of Drinks, the podcast that's completely original.
With nothing fake, fraudulent or faux here. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's a question of drinks, all one word, at gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.